History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories, amazing stories, with the power to change your perspective right there in your midst. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we end up benefiting. One thing's for sure, we learn a lot. We're definitely educated. We're also entertained. And in the end, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm excited about the stories we're going to hear in the weeks ahead, like next week when we hear from a veteran who was part of a very small minority in World War II. In fact, only about 0.1%. 16 million Americans served in our armed forces during the war, but only 20,000 or less were Chinese American. And we're going to meet one very special Chinese American veteran next time. Today, though, you're going to hear from several voices, some still with us, some who have left us. But hopefully, together, their stories will present a mosaic of what was happening in the world 75 years ago this week. If you've ever been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., you know how impressive and how moving that special place can be. That holds true 365 days a year, but this week was a busier week than usual around the memorial because of a series of 75th anniversary commemorations. Just in this week alone, there have been ceremonies there for the 75th anniversary of the bloody Battle of Peleliu in the Pacific, for Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, for the Battle of Angar right next to Peleliu, and then for the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest. All of those were in progress 75 years ago today, and that doesn't even bring into play what was happening in Italy, along the Gothic Line, or what was going on throughout the massive China-Burma-India theater. All around the globe, Americans were fighting for and dying for our freedom. Let's start with the words of Major General Mark Schwartz at the National World War II Memorial this week, giving us an overview of Operation Market Garden. And as you listen, know that we're also going to hear in this hour from men who carried out the actions he's describing. You'll also hear the uninterrupted flow of the memorial's fountains in the background, and you can find links to this special ceremony at hometownheroesradio.com.
17 September, the Allies launched Operation Market Garden. They deployed airborne and armored forces with the sole objective to capture key bridges in the Netherlands that would open a route across the Rhine River and into the Third Reich's industrial complex at the time, the Ruhr Valley. This campaign was technically two operations. Operation Market was led by the British 1st Airborne Division under the ultimate leadership of Montgomery. And there were several thousand paratroopers and glidermen from the 101st Airborne Division, the 82nd Airborne Division, and the 1st Polish Parachute Brigade. They conducted their airborne infiltration more than 60 miles behind enemy lines that, you know, without really any support. Enabled by the Dutch resistance, who played a key role in the intelligence preparation and the actual execution of Operation Market Garden, from their landing zones, the paratroopers fought to capture several key crossings at Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem, attempting to seize a very narrow corridor for the eventual follow-on in advance of the 30th Corps. The following operation, codenamed Garden, was led by the British 30th Corps and dispatched British armor and mechanized forces to link up with these paratroopers and push through across the Rhine River.
That was Major General Mark Schwartz at the World War II Memorial this week. Now let's hear about that airborne assault from one of the men who flew a one-way mission in a powerless glider behind enemy lines. We'll hear Morris Bennett explain where he was headed and how that mission unfolded.
Arnhem, Nijmegen, we had Grossbeck, and we had the 82nd Airborne is what we took in. And we didn't have enough pilots, so we didn't even have a co-pilot. And part of the equipment I had, there was a trailer with all the signal equipment, all the electronics for the communications for the whole group. So I had a trailer with that and the two people that worked with it. Some of them were shot down on the way in, but we knew it was going to be a rough mission. It was about 3 hours on tow, and we left somewhere around 7 in the morning. It was in September. We had May West, but I put an extra flak suit under my seat and went over my legs and went over my deal. And right after we hit the coast of the Rhodes, we were shot at by ground fire of barges on the bottom, and then we were shot at also by fighters. But the Spitfires came in and the P-51s came in, off defense boys, and they took those out and they took out the other deal. But I could see the tracers coming down. You see them going through the side of the tow ship and come out on down the tow line. And then by that time, they were going through ours. And that was probably the scariest mission that I had, as far as wondering if I was even going to get on the ground. But after we got over the barges and got a little further inland, we were able to land. But I was picking up ground fire after I hit the CP. And we landed about 10:30 in the morning, and paratroopers were dropping at the same time we dropped. Normally, paratroopers come in ahead of us and clear the ground before we get in, but we were on the ground at the same time that they were. First Lieutenant ran over to me, and he says, I kind of cracked up a little bit. I mean, I had to get on the ground because I was being shot at pretty heavy.
And that glider, with what it's made out of, doesn't take fire very well.
And so I landed a little bit faster than I normally would land, and it was sandy. And I nosed over, so I just knocked the nose end of it off a little bit, but the load and everything else was on the ground in good shape. I landed right by an ammunition dump. There were all kinds of ammunition and guns and everything. There were stacks of them that the Germans had got together. And I says, I think I'm okay. In other words, of course, I was kind of dusty and dirty. Of course, you got probably 30 pounds of equipment, your helmet and all the other gear and the ammunition, and your legs are full of groceries for 3 or 4 days or whatever the case would be. You have everything on you that you don't have no chance of picking nothing up. You're all ready to go. So when you landed, you got out of there. We went over to this castle, and the German officers had just left it having breakfast. Everything was still ham and eggs and everything just on the table when we landed. And so we stayed there that afternoon, and then that night they marched us downtown, and we took the bridge that crossed the Rhine, the 82nd Airborne mortar fire was hitting us pretty heavy. So they come over and said, in other words, well, you glider pilots, you are guards, you're going to be MPs. So I was an MP for 3 weeks with about 10 glider pilots, and we had over 3,000 prisoners. And we took an apple orchard that had a high deer fence around it. They couldn't come in and reinforce us or bring in any more troopers, and they tried to by air, but the weather was bad. And they made some paradrops. After paradropped it, they dropped in the German lines, and the Germans got them. And this was at Nijmegen, or the Arnhem, which is a bridge too far. There's a movie on the bridge too far. Well, this is where it was. And so about 3 weeks, we were relieved. They finally got through to us. The British came in and with the tanks and relieved us, and we went back. And I don't even remember how we ate. We didn't eat very much. In other words, I know that, because all we had was K-rations with Cracker Jack boxes. But anyway, we got back on this Army 6x6, and then while I was sitting there, like we sat on benches on that thing, and one of the guys that was with us, in other words, he didn't unload his gun or did something, and it went off in the truck bed. But in other words, none of us was hurt.
So that's one of the glider pilots from Operation Market Garden, happening 75 years ago today. Some of the paratroopers from that campaign have actually been back in the Netherlands this week, thanks to our friend Donnie Edwards and his Best Defense Foundation, which has been feeding back live videos with the vets from Holland. You'll find this video with 82nd Airborne Paratrooper Hugh Wallace at hometownheroesradio.com. He explains how he survived the daring crossing of the Wall River in a canvas rowboat on September 20th, 1944.
First, I'd say we was under the command of the British, and they was going to bring boats up for us to cross. And we didn't know there was going to be canvas rowboats till they got there. And they were supposed to bring 33, I was told, and they only brought 23, so we had to overload them. There was probably 15, 16 on our boat, yeah, something like that. They only had 4 pedals per boat. Some of the guys used the butt of the rifle to pedal, but I had one of the pedals, and I was in the back of the boat on the bridge side, and I was in the second boat from the bridge. We got about halfway across, and word came back from the front that our medic up front had been killed, some of our guys hurt. We got just a little bit further on, and I felt the boat paddle, my hand move, and there was a hole come through the boat. I was on my knees. It was below the water line. Whatever it was went right between my legs, but didn't touch me. I thought, I got to stop that water. I put one knee in, didn't do much good, and I thought I was going to put two in. I went to raise up, and I was in the water. Until this day, I don't know how I got in the water. Where I fell in, jumped in, somebody knocked me in. I had a good friend that was a little further up in the boat, but he went to the bottom, and he told us, he said, couldn't swim because I had too much weight on me. I knew I couldn't, so he says, I just started walking. When I went in, I went to the bottom, and I was pulling my gear off. I probably had 70 pounds on. I got up to the top, got my breath two or three times, and down. I was up and down two or three times. And I don't know which time it was, but when I started back down, I'd been hit now, or I don't know how much blood I'd lost. But I knew that was it. Just seemed like everything went peaceful all at once. And why? I guess it was the good Lord. I raised my head up and I saw something. I reached up and grabbed it, and it was a boat pedal, and they pulled me in another boat.
Oh, wow.
Or I wouldn't be here.
Wow.
That was Hugh Wallace of the 82nd Airborne on how he survived the crossing of the Wall River 75 years ago this week. Thanks to Donnie Edwards and his Best Defense Foundation for that. Check out the full video online. And remember when General Schwartz mentioned the Dutch resistance working with American intelligence? Well, John Cardinale was part of that intelligence apparatus. He was there with the OSS, predecessor to the CIA. He was supervising 9 different secret agents operating behind enemy lines.
While they're fighting back and forth, the Germans on one side and Allies on the other, they wanted to know how strong they were on the other side, the German. They sent us a message, so I round up Kaja, my best agent, good operator. We got underwear for German underwear, German shoes, long wool stockings with holes in them, showed that they're poor, you know. And he got her a German bike, German bottle of water, not like bottled water. We had a regular jar, like fruit jar. That was their bottle of water, round loaf of bread, hard as a rock. We didn't cut it. It was broken in half. Yeah. And I had her bite into the bread 2 or 3 times with her teeth because the Germans, the Gestapo, were pretty sharp. They were just as sharp as we are. So in case they had her come across, they would check teeth mark, check this mark, check. They knew everything. Anyway, they checked the sock and all that wool sock. Anyway, we rounded up clothing for this car. You had to go across the river with me, Rhine River, that one, the bicycle. And we had a couple blanket each, a radio. I had a radio for her, Morse key. And I had a radio myself and a blanket. She had a bicycle. And I rode her across the Rhine River like 1 in the morning, dark night, 1 in the morning. Our side were all notified. We're coming over. Didn't say who's coming, but we're coming. So don't shoot anybody going across the Rhine River. Okay, that order not to shoot it. Anyway, we went across about 1:30 in the morning, dark as hell. We reached the other side, on the German side, that's behind the enemy lines. The Rhine River is a border. And I pulled the boat up, a rubber boat, the engineers had furnished the doors. And I pulled it up about, from the little coastline there, maybe 40, 50 feet, pulled it up. And you got some bushes hid behind inside there. I went back to the coast, got branch, kind of wiped off the boat markings being dragged to where we're staying that night. Anyway, cleaned all that up, and we laid there in the boat together. Blanket was cold. And I told Kaja, I said, listen, comes daylight, I want you to go out there about 100 feet from where I'm staying on your bike. Stop, get off the bike, and make out you're fooling around with your bike or something. Fiddle around with it, you know, to show that it's broken or something. So the other bikes would go by. So if you want two bikes go by, do not join them. When you see 4 or 5, then you get up, get in your bike, and join them. So a few bikes went by. She's still there fiddling around with her bike. After a bunch came in, 4 or 5 or 6, I forgot how many there were, and she got on her bike and joined them. Now she's going down on enemy side. So the guards, I guess, knew these people going to work or somewhere. They blew a lot of face, you know, and passed her by. She had a passport and everything, you know. So they went this and she went that way, more or less. And she got herself a boarding house. She stayed there, and she started sending me messages that she's all right. Okay, so I stayed there that night, watching out what's going on, operating, sending messages back to our lines.
And where were you this whole time?
I was hiding in the boat with the bushes around me so they wouldn't see me from the highway. I was off the highway maybe 30, 40 yards, maybe, away from the highway. A lot of Army German army truck, tank, whatever, going by, troop trucks, and I radioed this back to our side. They were taking it all in. Now, I was there a few days. She took up with a German captain, I think it was, a high officer, anyway. I'll put it this way. She was shacking up with them, okay? That's her job as an agent. That's part of your job, to get information. So, but he was revealing everything to her. He was revealing everything to her, and I would send it back to our side, Allied side, and finally they went over across and got over Kaja. She was safe, and that was Kaja's mission. That was her first mission. Kaja, my best operator, I think it was, says paid her a couple $3,000. I'm not sure. Operation there was very good. We sent her back to our lines way back there. About a month or so later, we get a message. Kaja's killed. And I said, well, how come it happened? Her and some corporal army driver driving a Jeep in a side road and blew up in landmine. Not the main road. Main road is all clear of mines, you know. But the side road, they even said that. Not cleared of any landmine. It went sky high. That poor guy. She was a good operator.
And when you were talking about the Rhine and you're hiding out in the bushes, you said for about 3 days?
Something like that. I'm not sure, but quite a few days, you know, until we got information we needed.
But how nerve-wracking was that? I mean, there's Germans just crawling over the whole area. You had to be afraid they'd be discovered.
I tell you. I hate to say that, but you know the old saying, you have white shorts? My shorts were white. Anyway, it was scary. I wouldn't know John Wayne, you know, or people like that. You know, you fired an Indian, six go down with one shot. I want to talk about John Wayne. He had applied for OSS. He wanted a captain's rating right off the bat. A captain rating, back because well-known and all that. That was John Wayne. OSS said, no, you got to go through the rank like all these other guys that pay like us. He wanted a captain's rating. They wouldn't let him, so he didn't join the OSS. OSS is pretty strict.
And pretty active 75 years ago. That was OSS agent John Cardinale, who passed away 2 years ago at the age of 96. He wrote a book about his experiences, and you can link to that at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we go to the other side of the world and what was happening in the Pacific 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I've realized, like maybe you have, that over the next 12 months, we're going to have a steady progression of 75th anniversaries of significant World War II events, culminating, of course, with the 75th anniversary of VJ Day in a little less than a year. This will be the last significant round of anniversaries while a remnant of our greatest generation is still with us. So let's make sure we mark those anniversaries and give those courageous Americans the credit they're due. The Friends of the National World War II Memorial is an organization committed to doing exactly that. That's a great follow on social media, by the way, if you want to stay updated on World War II anniversaries. This week, the memorial in our nation's capital had four such ceremonies, including two on the same day, September 17th. You heard General Mark Schwartz's introduction to Operation Market Garden. Now, again with the memorial's fountain roaring underneath, here's the general on two dramatically different battles unfolding 75 years ago this week on two islands just 6 miles apart in what is now the Republic of Palau, east of the Philippines.
Concurrently in the Pacific Theater, on September 17th, the 81st Infantry Division, newly formed, continued the campaign of Palau by conducting the amphibious landing of Ongar. And while Marines wrestled with controlling a neighboring island of Peleliu, Ongar was successfully fought and captured in just 4 days. However, the resistance certainly wasn't over then. There were still significant Japanese defenders in a whole series of cave complexes that harassed American troops.
And we've heard from quite a few of those American troops over the years. A great book, by the way, on the Battle of Peleliu is Brotherhood of Heroes by Bill Sloan. One of its subtitles is The Bloodiest Battle of the Pacific War. The 1st Marine Division certainly found that out. So how crazy would it be for someone in the less volatile Battle of Angar, 6 miles away, to volunteer to head to Peleliu and its infamous Bloody Nose Ridge? Chuck Munson of the 154th Combat Engineers did exactly that.
Well, we'd had all sorts of amphibious landings. I landed on the coast of California 3 or 4 times, on San Clemente Island and on Guadalcanal. So we were all ready to, we knew how to get in those PT boats and go in a circle and come in a wave. And I still remember to this day when we were at Anguar going in on, I was in this Higgins boat, and there was 40 guys in there, all of them with loaded guns, and I knew how flaky a lot of them were. And I was about as worried by them all with loaded guns as the Japanese on the beach, you know. But we had an uneventful landing, but at night you could hear these land crabs walking around, and you'd swear it was the Japanese coming. And we took turns in the foxhole, but it was... We had kind of a quiet time in our part of Anguar, and a call came out that they wanted volunteers to go over and help the Marines on Bloody Nose Ridge. And about 40 of us volunteered to go that. I was reading a company history recently, and they call them the 40 Fools.
And this is on the island of Peleliu, so all before Okinawa and Iwo Jima and all of that.
Yeah, we were on Anguar, which is a smaller island off of Peleliu. So then we got in boats and went over to Peleliu Island and was slodging up through the jungle.
And you were one of the 40 fools.
Yes.
You wear that proudly.
I don't. But I was in a line of soldiers, and I got a bullet in each leg. And it felt like a 2x4 hitting me, and I felt the blood running into my socks, and I laid down. Well, I remember a second lieutenant said, when a bullet went right between his legs over my head. So then the fellas in the squad, they took small trees and threaded them through jackets and made a stretcher. They took their jackets and made a stretcher, and it took 8, 10 guys all day long to get carry me down out of there.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with the Battle of Peleliu, who aren't familiar with the catastrophic losses that occurred there that weren't expected because American forces had no idea how dug in the Japanese were, what kind of network of tunnels they had there. Describe for us what Bloody Nose Ridge was and what you guys were trying to do and what you later found out actually happened to you.
Well, I'm probably not that good at. But it was rough jungle land, and it was jagged peaks. I wasn't involved that long, really. I was wounded soon and was on a troop ship going back to Guadalcanal. I thought I was going home, but I didn't. They sent me back to Hawaii.
Going back to Bloody Nose Ridge, and you're being wounded. I want people to understand what's happening here, because you guys didn't know where the Japanese were, right? You couldn't see Japanese forces. You were kind of blindsided, I bet, right?
I saw a jungle, and I was trained as a demolition man and had a satchel, an explosive satchel on my back. This was a plastic explosive. I used to know It's like a big slab of
C4 or something?
Cedo, yes. You could slap it up against a bridge and blow it out. But this was for blowing them out of caves and pillboxes. So, but I didn't get to that point. I got wounded before I got there.
When you talk about the explosives, I obviously didn't get the training you did, so I don't know how it works, but could those explosives be set off by gunfire? No, you had to detonate them yourself.
Most high explosive demolitions are rather stable and have to be set off with a blasting cap. You have a match compound in the blasting cap, and you set it off with a charge. Later on in Okinawa, I did a lot of demolition work blasting coral to be hauled off to make airports.
Grind it and make a runway out of it. Yeah. So you don't know where the Japanese are. You've got this satchel full of explosives. You're planning to maybe drop in some caves or chase them out of some bunkers. And then all of a sudden, shots ring out? What?
There's 30 or 40 of us in a line going up this ridge. And it's rough going, you know. There's no path or anything. And all of a sudden, the firing started, and I got hit. Later on, people in my platoon were killed in the next day or two.
It probably crossed your mind when you did get hit, if you got shot in both legs, that you could die right there on Bloody Nose Ridge.
You know, my first thought was I was going to go home a hero and see my wife. But I didn't. I got married just before I went overseas. It was a good feeling to get down out of there and be put on a Jeep ambulance thing and taken to a tent, you know, and then very soon I was taken out to a hospital ship and put on it. And in about 3 days, I walked to the bathroom because I couldn't stand the bedpan. And so I was walking in 3 days. Kind of a comical note, was in this hospital in an island close to Guadalcanal Island, and one of the orders would sweep the floor. He'd say, in those days there was a song, Straighten Up and Fly Right. And he'd say, Straighten Up and Die Right. Straighten Up and Die Right. Funny.
Yeah, I'm sure that goes over real well with a bunch of wounded soldiers around. Yeah,
a lot of them are hurt bad, you know. I saw some guys that were really hurt.
I imagine part of your mind was with those other guys that were still on the ridge, not knowing what happened to them. And if you were able to walk in 3 days after getting shot in both legs, sounds like maybe somebody was looking out for you, or maybe that wife back home was praying for you.
It's about a 27 caliber shell, and both of them went right into the bone. There's one right there.
A scar on your knee that's still here.
Still in the bone, and yeah, scar. I'm kind of proud of this because it shows I wasn't running away. It's sort of from the front, you know.
That is right above the knee from the front of the leg, so they didn't hit you in the back.
Lower, they'd have shot me in the knee, you know.
And then you wouldn't be walking. So you got hit in a pretty good place.
I think so, yeah. Later on, pieces of cartridge came out. Some of the cartridge came with the bullet, with the slug.
And you still have some metal in there?
Well, they left the bullets in. They never did operate. They just sprinkled sulfur powder in the holes, and I healed up, and they sent me back to another company to go to Okinawa.
So there is a piece of lead stuck in your femur just above your knee?
Both knees, yeah. Uh-huh. One here and one here.
Well, I guess that helps you straighten up and fly, right?
Yeah.
So after that, obviously you're recovering. You talked about being sent back to Hawaii. You probably were hoping they'd send you all the way to California and see your young bride.
Well, I thought sure that I was going home and have leave or something, but they didn't bother with that. They just sent me back to Leyte and put me in another company.
I'm curious, when you talk about your wife, and you married her right before you went over, so you guys hadn't had much time together as a married couple. A day, all of one day. Did you at least get to talk to her on the telephone, tell her you were all right?
No, never talked to her.
So you got a telegram saying you're wounded?
I got wounded. I stopped getting mail for 6 months. And when I finally got it, they got it before I was sailing for Okinawa. And so I read letters, you know, all day long.
Well, I'm just curious. After coming so close as you did, and you still have the bullets in both of your knees to prove it, what were you thinking when you got sent back to Okinawa and here you are in another bloody battle? Did you think you were going to survive it?
Oh, yeah. You don't think you're going to get killed, you know, when you're 18.
When you saw her again, saw that she was still there waiting for you, can you describe what that felt like after everything that you've been through, been wounded, survived some of the bloodiest battles of the Pacific War, and then you had that happy ending?
Well, it just felt wonderful. It just really great. We went on. We'd married 62 years when she passed away.
So when you think back about World War II, and when you think of your kids or grandkids or people that weren't alive while it was going on, what do you think is important for them to realize about what you and all the guys like you did?
They should realize that everyone pulled together. We were all, it was no sure thing that we were going to win the war. I never did have that invincible feeling. It was do or die, and we all pulled together. Everyone just, it was really great in a way, because I had a feeling that we were all together.
Chuck Munson, wounded on Peleliu's Bloody Nose Ridge with the 154th Combat Engineers, is still going, and he's still blogging at age 94. I have a link to his blog for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet. When we come back, another man wounded on Peleliu 75 years ago, and a couple decisions he made that saved his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. In a week, we mark the 75th anniversary of multiple World War II battles. One of them, the bloody fight for Peleliu in the Palau Group in the Northern Pacific. With the 81st Infantry Division there was a young man named Francis Cowles.
Yeah, on Peleliu, why, the Marines, like you said, were the ones that had the object of taking the island and more or less trying to secure it, you know. And, of course, if you looked on the island itself when we got there, of course, a lot of the battlements were disposed of, and you know, through the Marine Corps. And they had what they call Radar Hill, which had radio-controlled howitzers that protected the island from ships and stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And then if you'd have seen them... all that armament that they had there, they were well protected. And plus the fact that that island had been a mining by the Germans for fertilizer before World War I. And the Japanese got that for their participation in securing World War I, you know. So they were given that island. And on that island, it was just a mine island of hills. They weren't what I call mountains, but they were hilly. It was all hilly, and it was all limestone. And they were 3 and 4 stories deep, that they had time to prepare those emplacements and stuff. You could actually hear them through the limestone, you know, that was...
The
in
tunnels.
The tunnels, you could actually hear them. And it was kind of scary. You didn't know when they were going to come out, you know. And they had it all lined up so that they had good fields of fire, you know, to protect their interests. And the worst part was Bloody Nose Ridge, you know, which it was a hill that had a big tree on it, right at the tip of it. And the bombing and everything tried to dig it out, but it was a hollow tree, and it was an observation point for the enemy to see all our movements and stuff and concentrate the fire, you know, on anybody that was trying to take the hills. And so they would let you get into the clearings. There was the other tree on the hill. Just if you wanted to take it a forward position, why, you just had a clear feel of having to run up that hill. But when you got up to a certain point, they opened fire. They had it all crossed.
There wasn't a whole lot to hide behind.
There was nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. No rocks or nothing.
And just to put a little perspective on it for our listeners, the Japanese, as far as anyone can tell looking back, the Japanese had approximately 11,000 men on the island to start with. 10,695 of those 11,000 were killed. On the American side, the Marines sent over 17,000. There are about 11,000 from the 81st Infantry Division. Between the Marines and the Army, almost 10,000 were either wounded or killed. Almost 10,000 casualties with just under 1,800 killed. You were one of more than 8,000 to be wounded. Tell us the story of the day when you were wounded and how that came about. You described for us that there wasn't anything to hide behind. I imagine that was the case on that day.
Well, the thing of it was, they tried to take this observation point out, and they could overrun it, but they could not succeed in holding them down because it was all, in other words, where they had caverns underneath. And they did take it out, but a lot of times, but then they'd move over it, but they would go back into them because they were all interconnected by caves. They tried to take that, well, every day they made an assault on that position.
Had you been there before, or was this the first time for you?
Well, it was the first time for me. And then when it come our turn to take it, we got the orders from the general, Holland Smith, who was on a battleship out in the Pacific there, and he was in charge of the Marine Corps for the operation of the island there, but the Army was to back him up, you know.
Right, right.
So they put out the order that they had to take it at all costs, you know. So every day they put a new regiment in there to try and take that position. That's why there were so many casualties.
What you said just struck me. When they say, we need to take it at all costs, and you hear that, you say, wait a second, I might be the cost.
You go, yes, that's for sure.
Well,
and I didn't intend to be the cost. Everybody that tried to take that position didn't come back, you know. Well, the lieutenant came, and he just come up to me, and he says, Cowles, are you yellow? And I says, no, sir, I'm just saying my prayers. And as I said that, he got shot in the mouth.
Mm.
And I don't know the end results of that, but anyway, they wiped out the rest of the squad, you know, that was on the hillside. And then the company commander and the first sergeant, they were in their tent and they had a critique, and they, it was a, I didn't know why they had a critique, but anyway, he wanted to appoint me as a squad leader for another squad to take up the next day.
Well, and one of the reasons for that was you're the only one left. 12 guys went out, the other 11 were killed?
Yeah, but he gave me another squad.
How did you survive that? How did you escape when the other 11 guys were killed?
Well, because I they opened fire just as I was talking to the lieutenant.
Right.
And that ended the
they picked
the
them
series.
All off at that moment.
Yes.
But because you were behind the rock.
Well, I was standing there talking to the lieutenant, you know.
Right, right.
And he got shot in the mouth, through the mouth, you know. And that ended the conversation and everything. I don't know whether he got killed or not. But anyway, that about an hour later, I was notified to report to the captain's tent, you know. They wanted a critique on this here.
Right. So that had been unsuccessful. You're the only one unharmed from that squad. They give you a new squad, you and 11 other guys.
and say, tomorrow, you need to take this position. But this is something that's a little bit rare in the Army. They gave you some input here. They let you tell them how you thought you could take this point.
Well, no, I told them that I would not take it and follow their orders. I would take it under my terms. Instead of taking a frontal assault on a hill, we were going to go take it by the crest of the hill,
mm-hmm.
where I would have protection from the gunfire because it'd either go over my head or hit into the side of the hill. I was safe, you know, unless I exposed myself beyond the rocks, you know.
Because I guess first they said, we want you to take it, and you go the same way that they've been going, and you said, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that?
That's right. That's what I told them.
Because you felt you'd just be leading these soldiers into their deaths.
That's what I told them. I didn't figure out if I wanted to be a goat to lead sleepless slaughter. A lot of times I had talked to the commander, you know, when they asked for volunteers, and nobody would take the volunteers, and then he would give me the volunteer job, but then he would give me permission to do it the way I thought I could do it, not the way that the Army says you had to do it. We'll have a satchel charge, which we can drop down into this observation point there, and so that they can't get up there to give directions to the to their troops. And that's what we did. They had to have a little time to crawl back up, you know, because they were down undercover there so that they wouldn't get wounded, you know, from the artillery shells and everything that they were using to try and penetrate that observation point.
So the long and short of it is your plan worked.
It
would,
did.
Would you say that you caught the Japanese by surprise, that they were unprepared for?
Well, in other words, how many times did they try it? We were doing the same thing every day.
So they
never were expecting anything different.
Mm-hmm. So you caught them by surprise. You dropped the charges down this hollowed out tree on top of the hill. That's their observation post.
They didn't have no observation anymore, see?
So you had taken that position.
Yes, but I says, we ain't going to hold this very easy, you know. I said, they're going to get this tonight. That was the only thing they had left.
Yeah, this is getting on. That battle had started September 15th, so you're more than a month after it began, October 23rd. But I understand that night.
They come, you know, about 2 o'clock in the morning to try and retake the position. But because of the loose rock, which they was on the side of the hill, which they hollowed out from the caves, was loose. And anybody stepping on that would slide a little bit, and you'd hear them coming, you know.
So that's what woke you up at 2 in the morning?
Yeah.
Or gunfire?
Well, no, that's what woke me up. And then they called for flares. They lit the flares up, and then right from here, a little further than the door away from me, was this Japanese standing by a tree, just froze.
It's about 20 feet away.
Yeah.
So that the sky lights up and you see a Japanese soldier 20 feet away.
Yeah, but he froze.
Mm-hmm.
They were told not to move when you have light because you're a target then.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to give away my position where I was hid, you know, because I had a rocked embankment around my position. I figured if I missed him, he'd know where I was. I didn't want him to let him know where my position was, so I didn't fire while the flare was up. I was waiting for the flare to dim down and go down, and then at that moment I would fire. And I fired, and he just disappeared down the hill. Then all hell broke loose with rocket or 4.2 millimeter mortars. One of the boys had called for assistance because of the Japs trying to take over the position.
Right.
And some of the mortar shells exploded up in the air. And I had an old grenade box it was made of oak wood. It took two people to carry, you know, with these grenades. And I just put it over my chest, you know, to protect myself. And the minute I got it over there, that old shrapnel just stuck into that wood there.
And so you knew that these shells were coming?
You couldn't help it because they were exploding above the ground, and the shrapnel was just going all over.
So you said to yourself, I've got to get something to protect myself. You grab this grenade box, throw it over your chest, and all of a sudden, rat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah, that's when I got wounded. And then they...
Where did it get you?
It got me in the hands. I was holding it, you know.
But if you didn't have that grenade box, it would have gotten your hands and your heart and everything else. Yeah.
So anyway, the company commander, he called up there, and he says, do you need a medic, you know? And I says, don't send anybody up. I says, it's hell up here, you know. I says, I'll make it through, you know, till morning, you know, and then I'll go down and get...
So you got patched up the next morning?
Yeah.
You ever think about what would have happened if that grenade box wasn't there?
I don't know. See, we carried that thing up there. That was what we were using for dropping down. After the satchel charges went off, then we were using grenades to drop it on every few minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good thing you took it up there.
Sure it was.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me.
That's right.
And in fact, that same area, Bloody Nose Ridge, which had given you some bloody fingers, but not taken your life, you'd be asked to go reinforce and take over. You had the position. The Americans had the position. You think there's not a whole lot to worry about. You're just going up the hill to take over for the guys who are there. But that's not exactly how it happened. Tell us about this day when something caught your eye on the way up Bloody Nose Ridge.
Well, in the service, they always relieved the troops, you know, so that they could get away from the action. And there wasn't any particular thing to fear because I figured we had taken the opposition out, and I was just going up the hill the normal way that they were making all these frontal assaults. And as I was going up there, I was in the crouch position just in case that things were, I always walk with a crouch going uphill in a way, you know.
Well, especially when you describe this island, like so many islands in the Pacific, a network of tunnels, you never know where they're hiding, so.
Yeah, so anyway, as I was walking up, I happened to spot a shiny object that took my eye, you know, and I thought, well, I bent down to pick it up, and just as I bent down to pick it up, the machine gun opened fire, you know. So I stayed down and crawled the rest of the way, you know, so that I wouldn't be hit. And I was just lucky to have spotted that item. I don't know how it got there.
So Abe Lincoln saved your life.
Yeah, you might say so. I just figured the good Lord took care of me many, many, many times because I had grenades go roll right at my feet and not go off. I had rifle shells take my helmet off of my head, you know, but not scar me. I was just blessed.
And we're blessed to have known men like Francis Cowles who shed their blood on our behalf. There's a lot we've covered today, and I have a ton of links for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Next week, we'll be back to our formula of one veteran for the whole hour, but I hope you enjoyed this multi-pronged approach today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.